I'm Edmund Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, we'll go foraging for wild mushrooms in the heart of L.A. It's possible. And I take a look at a new cultivated mushroom operation that produces some gorgeous fungi. The bagel has a dense history. Who knew? The story of this crossover sensation on the show today. Plus, Bon Appetit editor Barbara Fairchild does justice to the lowly chicken breast. But first, let's get to the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Evan Funke is the executive chef at Rustic Canyon Restaurant right here in Santa Monica at 11th and Wilshire. Tell us, now you're here shopping again, tell us what you're finding and what you're going to be cooking from the market.
Well, I'm seeing a few things. I'm seeing a lot of greens popping up, which I'm very happy to see. What I'm also seeing is the tail end of some beautiful persimmons. I've been using persimmons for the last month. The Fuyu variety.
Those are the hard, crispy ones.
Beautiful. Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very sweet, delicious, delicate flavor. So what I've paired with those beautiful persimmons is a little shaved fennel, some figs from Dates by Duval, the persimmons, of course, the shaved fennel, and some apples, which is a very lovely salad mixed with a little bit of Meyer lemon vinaigrette, which the Meyers have been popping up. The Meyer lemon vinaigrette is going to bring out the delicate notes in the salad.
Right. Now, is this put on a bed of greens?
No.
Oh,
this is all just a composed salad.
Nice. Very nice. Now, these persimmons have seeds, and when I'm cutting them, you get that seed, and you got to kind of go around it.
It's not really a seed. Yeah. The center is kind of, it has like a marshmallow type of texture in the center. Mm-hmm. And they're not really seeds. Everything is actually edible. It gets a little astringent in the center, so we core it out and just use the meat around. It.
Oh, okay. Okay, and then slice them in circles and then rounds.
On a mandolin.
Very thin, yeah.
On a mandolin,
and you don't
absolutely.
Have to peel them first, though.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
And tell us now, there's going to be a bakery opening soon?
Yes. It's called Huckleberry. It's around 10th and Wilshire, and we're going to be doing pastries, rotisserie chicken, takeaway dinners, some retail cheeses, olive oils, vinegars, absolutely top-of-the-line stuff.
When is it going to open?
We're shooting for mid-February, early March.
That was Evan Funke, executive chef at Rustic Canyon, which is located at 11th and Wilshire, right here in Santa Monica. David Karp, the fruit detective, is here today. He's back from his world travels doing his fruit research at remote, undisclosed corners of the planet. And David is back today, and he's talking now with us about a Buddha's hand citron, which is an extremely interesting looking, I guess not all that uncommon, but very, very interesting looking thing with a lot of fingers on it. And it's yellow and it's citrusy. So David, what is it? Where did it come from? And what are its uses?
Well, let's describe, because it is so extraordinary looking, to listeners who might not have seen one before, what it looks like. It looks like a cross between a lemon and a giant squid. It's, this one maybe weighs, I don't know, 3/4 of a pound or something, but some of them can have as many as 50 fingers. This one has maybe 20 fingers, 30 fingers or something like that. So it starts out looking like a lemon and then is digitized. Not in the computer sense, but it actually dactylizes it. It turns into fingers. So the separate carpels, notice the word that I'm using, are separate and grow independently. It's all rind. There's no flesh on the inside, no seeds either. It's exquisitely aromatic. Flavor chemists say that it has the aroma of osmanthus, which is a flower grown specifically for its aroma in China and elsewhere.
And it grows, it originated in China?
That was the purpose of my trip. I spent a month in China mostly to try to track down the true center of origin for citron. Citron is the father of the lemon, and specifically the father and not the mother. It's the pollen parent. Mm-hmm. And a normal citron, as opposed to a Buddha's hand, just looks like a big, freaky, lumpy lemon. And it's used for two purposes primarily. I mean, for many purposes, but primarily. One is for Jewish ritual use. It's harvested immature in July through September and used in the Sukkot Harvest Festival. And then it's also used, the common citron, which just looks like a big lemon, is also used for fruitcake. The rind is brined and candied.
So these are ones with very little juice or seeds or pulp, all rind.
It's all rind. So what do you do with this? First of all, it attracts attention. Vicky Bernard, who sells them at the corner here at the Santa Monica Wednesday Farmers Market, has to explain maybe 30 times or 50 times in the course of a market. People say, what is that? Because it's so extraordinary looking, and its aroma is quite catching, too. But it's also grown in many regions of China, like Guangdong and Sichuan and Yunnan, for traditional Chinese medicine. It's dried in the sun or in an oven, and then pulverized and used in teas and as combinations with many other ingredients in traditional Chinese medicine. You know, it's primarily really ornamental. It's almost more like a flower than a food.
Okay, so for all your holiday needs, you can come and get these Buddha's hand citrons and put them on the table or shave them into your martinis or bake with them or
well,
just
it's said that the Chinese traditionally would use them in temple alcoves to honor their ancestors, the gods, or whatever. In fact, I went to the city of Lishan, where the world's currently largest stone Buddha in the world is. It's like 200 feet tall or something like that. And I was photographed holding it up as if it were in the Buddha's hands.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And from there, you can sort of hear that I still have a little bit of a chest cold. I risked my life and my health to travel to the original inspiration for Shangri-La, the city of Muli, in the most remote corner of eastern Tibet and western Sichuan province, in search of the legendary sacred fragrant sun fruit of Muli, never before seen by a Westerner. I traveled to a city where they'd never seen a Westerner before, and nobody had ever seen this fruit, which is said to be intermediate between the Buddha's hand citron and the common citron. But that's another story.
That's another story. All right. Well, David, this is fantastic. And now, of course, again, we look at things through new eyes, having talked to you and learned ever so much more about it than we ever thought was possible. Thanks so much, David, as always.
Thanks, Laura.
That was David Karp, and he's the fruit detective, and he does travel the corners of the earth researching these fascinating fruit varieties. And you can find this amazing Buddha's hand citron right here at the Santa Monica markets and other markets where Vicky Bernard attends. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Want to see what Laura just talked about? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for all the details on today's market report. Also, I really hope that you'll join me on Saturday, January 17th for an Australian version of Good Food Live. I'll be talking with some of Australia's food producers and chefs, as well as looking at some really exciting Australian food products that are coming to the States. Tickets are just $15. The event takes place at the Paley Center in Beverly Hills, formerly known as the Museum of Television and Radio. Go to kcrw.com for more details. I hope to see you there. Whether it's a tough economy or a movement to get more authentic in your life, raising your own food sounds like a good idea. Before we foraged for food in plastic packaging, we actually used to collect food from the environment. Wild mushrooms are now one of those food items that defy cultivation, and you can actually go out in Los Angeles and find mushrooms to eat. Next on Good Food, I'll talk with a man who locates, identifies, and eats wild mushrooms from the concrete forest of L.A. Mushrooms are fascinating, various in type and deep in flavor. Who wouldn't want to learn more about them? Enough about them, in fact, to be able to actually forage with the knowledge that you can enjoy the bounty instead of maybe be killed by it. David Kahn is head of Sustainable Habitats, a nonprofit that concentrates on urban homesteading. He's also a member of the Los Angeles Mycological Society. Hi.
Hi, Everett. Good to be here.
Talk to me a little bit about the Los Angeles Mycological Society. What exactly do they do?
The Los Angeles Mycological Society, LAMS for short, is a nonprofit that teaches people about wild mushrooms and mainly identifying them and how to go look for them, go mushroom hunting. We do that once every couple of weeks in the season. It's something very dangerous if you don't really know what you're doing. You can eat the wrong mushroom.
I don't really think of Los Angeles as a mushrooming area. Tell me a little bit about what varieties are available here. What do you find and where do you find them?
Okay, when we go foraging for mushrooms, we go up to the mountains. We go to the Santa Monica Mountains. We go to the San Bernardino Mountains and also sometimes in Griffith Park and local places. But also, it's not surprising to find them in your own backyard. For instance, I had a load of wood chips delivered last year And to my surprise, I had morel mushrooms growing right after the rainy season. In the beginning, I was skeptical. I said, well, I better be absolutely sure. I took one of them to the meeting at the Mycological Society, and they definitely verified it that it's a morel. It's an authentic morel. I kept getting them for a whole year, and they were great.
If you go, like, let's say you're going to the Santa Monica Mountains, what are some varieties that you might run into?
Well, we run into a lot of varieties that, you know, they're not really your commercial varieties, for instance, although there are, like, some that, like, honey mushrooms, for instance, do exist. Morels is one other. Some of the button mushrooms also are available. We don't get into many of the, you know, the chanterelles and things that need a lot of rain and a lot of moisture here. But then there are many, many kinds that are very tasty and delicious to eat, but also some that have medicinal qualities, and people make teas out of other ones.
It seems like it's easier and easier to start playing with growing your own these days. There's all kinds of kits around.
Wonderful, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, because some of them are very easy to grow. You buy a kit, like you mentioned, and it basically comes with probably a plastic bag that has a spawn, which is the medium that the mushrooms grow in. And mushrooms start with spores, basically, and they spread their spores on the spawn, and this is how they grow. And basically, all you have to do is spray them with water that's been boiled or, you know, sanitized, because chlorine can kill the living organisms. In a week or two, you will get mushrooms. You can get up to a few pounds to feed a family from just one kit.
It's really impressive. Oyster mushrooms in particular.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Very simple.
Yeah, very, very simple and yeah, very, very delicious.
Let's talk about the danger for a minute. If you don't die from them, what can they do to your body? What part of the body gets really ravaged by mushrooms?
They can actually stop the liver from functioning. And it's very dangerous, because when someone gets mushroom poisoning, they can go very fast. And a lot of the hospitals actually hire mycologists to aid the doctors into identifying, you know, what kind of mushroom did this person ate.
How do you know, or how can you find out if a mushroom that you foraged, which I don't recommend that anybody go out there foraging alone if they know nothing, how can you get it identified and know whether or not it's edible or poisonous?
The only sure way to identify a mushroom is under the microscope or by experience. So, for instance, in my own experience, I learned a lot from going out foraging with the group. When you see a mushroom that's edible and you know exactly what it looks like because you know where it grows, for instance, under a particular tree, then you know for sure that this is, you know, not the poisonous one. And also they will show you which one is poisonous, and you learn to identify this right away, because a lot of them look very similar. And the danger for a novice is to actually mistake one for the other. But when you, let's say, turn it over and look at the gills, you can see, for instance, that one will have a little difference in color, you know, between the one that is poisonous versus another.
Does the society act as a screening for people who forage? Like, if someone who isn't a member finds a mushroom, can they call the society and get it identified?
Oh, absolutely. They will be very happy to do that. You can even take a picture and email them the picture. And a lot of times they can identify it from the picture, provided that you would tell them where you found it. And also the meetings are open to the public. Anybody can show up with a sample and be absolutely sure that they will go home with food, or they will make sure that they won't touch it again.
Before I let you go, let me ask about backyard mushrooms. The kind of mushrooms that we usually see in our front yard or backyard, it seems to be a standard type. We should stay away from those?
No, not necessarily, because you get a lot of different kinds, even though they may look similar. But my recommendation is to first identify it. It may be very, very well edible, and not just that. It will be very tasty, and you will have a whole source of food that you didn't know about in your backyard.
But really important to identify it before you eat it.
Absolutely.
Don't use yourself as a test subject.
No, not at all.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
David Kahn is Executive Director of Sustainable Habitats, a nonprofit which focuses on education of urban homesteading. He's also a member of the Los Angeles Mycological Society, the LAMS, and goes foraging for mushrooms. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for more info on the Mycological Society and the Homesteading Project. Some mushrooms defy cultivation, but others, like shiitake and portobello types, can be farmed. There's a new entry into medium-scale mushroom cultivating here in LA. I'll be back next to get an idea of what it's like to raise mushrooms. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Mushrooms. They're really easy to use in the kitchen, quick, flavorful, and with more nutritional value than you probably imagine. The varieties available to the home cook is about to increase geometrically because of a project by Hokuto, Japan's number one mushroom producer. Steve Farrar is chief operating officer of Golden Gourmet Mushrooms. They're a grower for the last 20 years of specialty mushrooms in San Marcos, California. Recently, Golden Gourmet received a huge investment from Hokuto to create a state-of-the-art growing facility and to distribute the mushrooms in the U.S. directly from California. And we are the lucky recipients. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What is a cultivated wild mushroom? It seems like it's an oxymoron.
Yes, we get that a lot. The idea of terming a cultivated wild mushroom is that they have a little bit of their wildness left to them, all the advantages of the flavor of a wild mushroom, but none of the downside in terms of varying quality, varying price, and limited availability on a seasonal basis. So these would substitute for a wild mushroom, have all the exotic appeal and the flavor appeal, but they're cultivated and none of the downsides of dirt and too dry, too wet, insects, and so on.
Tell us about this new state-of-the-art facility.
Oh, it's a wonderful facility. I call it a Star Wars mushroom farm. It's a 250,000 square foot facility equipped with a lot of robotics. It's a lot of equipment to handle. We grow the mushrooms in bottles, which sounds like it'd be a lot of work, but there's equipment that automates the handling of these bottles. They're reusable bottles, and we grow them out of the bottles. Even the harvesting is done robotically, so three out of the four mushrooms you grow are actually untouched by human hands.
Now, when you say they're grown in jars, in my mind, I think of a mason jar.
No, these are actually polypropylene jars, and they're a specially engineered polypropylene jar that can undergo the heat of sterilization in an autoclave. They have to withstand like 250 degrees Fahrenheit in pressure.
Isn't that the plastic that's kind of bad for us?
No, it's not. This is a high-density one, and growers in Japan have used these same jars for like 25 years with no degradation. They hold up really well, and as long as they're not abused and left out in the sunlight, they're very stable. The alternative is using a plastic bag that you throw away after each crop.
So describe these different mushrooms. I had the opportunity of playing with some of your mushrooms, and they're amazing.
We grow three different species, four different kinds. The brown and white beech that I mentioned, they're the same species, but a cultivar. There's a white cultivar and a brown cultivar. They're kind of a nutty flavor. They come in a cluster with a little bit of the base of the substrate that the mushroom is growing on. You just need to cut that off. Beech has kind of a nutty, buttery flavor to it, a little bit of a crunch to it if it's not overcooked. You don't need to wash them. They're grown on a sterilized substrate with no manures, no soils. Like I said, untouched by human hands, immediately packaged, so there's no post-harvest contamination issues. Maitake is another one we grow. That's one of my favorite of the cultivated ones. It's a very delicate, leafy-looking mushroom. A lot of people don't even recognize it as mushroom. It's known as hen of the woods in the common name in the United States. Very strongly flavored, very delicate. It hasn't caught on commercially because it's so perishable and it breaks so easy and loses moisture so easy and it goes slimy so easy. But in these packages, it just stays pristine for up to a month under refrigeration. The other one we grow is called the King Trumpet.
I love this mushroom.
Oh, it's a wonderful mushroom. It's like eating a piece of meat. The similar texture to meat, very solid, firm texture. The entire stem is edible. You don't have to trim it at all. Somewhat of a mild flavor that will lend itself to many different cooking styles, to whatever seasoning or sauce you might put on. I love it grilled. Just simply put on the grill and grill.
Yeah, I really like them just really hard sautéed in olive oil, just so they get really brown on the outside. Oh, they're just delicious. Now, talk to me for a little bit about the packaging.
It's an engineered film that's differentially permeable to the gases of metabolism. That's a lot of words, but essentially it means that when sealed in these packages, the carbon dioxide level builds up to the point where the metabolism of the mushroom shuts down and it stays for a long time, especially since it's got a little bit of a moisture reservoir and food reservoir with a little cluster of the substrate that it's on. They're also protected from mechanical damage. They're like in a little bubble so that you could throw them against a wall and they'll bounce off and look at them. You can't even tell that they're mechanical damage at all.
How long do they last in the packaging?
A phenomenal amount of time. People think I'm making this up, but kept refrigerated up to about 6 weeks in that packaging.
Yeah, I experimented with them. And for me, it was perfect because like everybody who shops at the farmers markets and who buys a lot of vegetables, I throw away a lot of slime. every month. So it was just fantastic to have a few of these packages. So tell me a little bit about the nutritional value of a mushroom. A lot of people just discount the nutritional value of a mushroom. They think, well, it's just water and there's nothing there.
Oh, no. Mushrooms are very good food. In fact, we call it a superfood. They're fairly high in protein, a well-balanced protein, about 3 grams per serving, something like that. They have quite a bit of vitamins in it. They're high in niacin, the B vitamins, high in minerals, potassium, selenium. Also, incidentally, very high in vitamin D, especially under this cultivation process. Mushrooms, when they're exposed to UV light, actually there's a precursor to vitamin D that's in the mushrooms, and it's converted by UV light into vitamin D.
That was Steve Farrar. He's Chief Operating Officer of Golden Gourmet Mushrooms. Start looking for these little beauties. They come in a little about 5-inch square package filled with these beautiful, pristine mushrooms. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. To find out more about the mushrooms, I'll have a link there to an LA Times article about their products and recipes. It's gift-giving season, and I really swear that some kitchen gadgets are designed to be given to others but never used oneself. Why people, for example, need to develop an alternative to using one's hands or a regular pan in the kitchen absolutely baffles me. Take ovens, for example. Do you happen to have a convection oven in your possession? What is it and why do you need to use it? Russ Parsons from the LA Times is back next to tell us. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Convection ovens. How many times have you tried to cook with one and just been astounded by your lack of knowledge? With us today to give us a few tips and hints is Russ Parsons, food writer, journalist, and sometime wine columnist of the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Russ.
Hey, Evan.
So convection ovens. Professional pastry chefs and cooks swear by them. But a lot of times home cooks have a little bit of a problem.
They're not for everything. It's a good alternative, I think. What a convection oven is in the first place, it's nothing really very fancy. It's a regular oven that has a fan and an exhaust on it. So what it does is it pulls the hot air across what's being cooked and then exhausts it. You know, in a regular oven, a lot of times, in the old days, they didn't consider oven baking really roasting. Like if you were roasting a chicken, if it was in the oven, it was baked. It wasn't really roasted because roasting depended so much on the dryness. And when you're cooking something like that in the oven, you develop so much humidity in the oven that there is a little bit of a steaming quality that goes on as well. I mean, it's been so long since any of us spit roasted over the fireplace. I think that that's kind of a point that's pretty much lost on the modern cook. But that's what convection ovens are designed to bring back, is that kind of very dry, very high heat. And so I find them really terrific for roasting meat. I don't really use them for other things. I mean, to be honest, I don't have one at home, although we have them at the test kitchen. I find, you know, like when you roast a chicken or roast some pork in it or something like that, you get that really nice crackly crust on it.
Do you have to set it at a lower temperature so that you don't get that beautiful crust and then inside it's still not quite done?
They usually call for setting the temperature about 25 degrees less than what the normal temperature would be. Pastry chefs like to use it, and it works really well for some kind of pastries, like for pie pastries, for example, because you really want to get that browning. You want it, you know,
and
you
cookies.
Want it to get that push on it. Yeah. Things like breads, for example, not so much. Cakes, I would never want to cook a cake in a convection oven. So you have to be very, very particular about how you use it.
But now there are these new ovens that combine convection and regular oven with microwave bursts.
Yes. A funny story. I remember they had sent, before Julia Child had died, when she was living in her retirement home up in Montecito, and I went to visit her, and she was complaining about it because they had sent her one as a sample. She was very, very frustrated in that kind of very Julia way, and she pulled out the instruction manual, and she said, "Would you look at this? She said, there's Hawaiian chicken. You know, the instructions have to be so specific to make things work.
It's totally programmed.
The recipe has to be written for the oven rather than, you know, you can't just like take something that you've cooked and do it in that. There's a Hawaiian chicken. There's a, you know, there's all of the, there's no roast chicken. I'm going to have them take it out and take it back. I'm not interested if it can't roast the chicken."
Aside from just lowering the temperature by 25 degrees, is there anything else we need to know about convection oven cooking?
I think the main thing to remember is, I mean, it's actually fairly simple. It's just the fan and the exhaust, and it's going to dry out whatever it is that you're cooking. So when you're approaching them, think about it from that angle.
So a casserole, because it's, maybe not?
You know, if it was a casserole with breadcrumbs on the top, you might want to bake it in a regular, you know, on the regular setting. And then when you put the breadcrumbs on, you know, switch it to convection, that kind of thing. That's the great thing about convection ovens, is that it's not either or, that you can turn the convection feature on and off as you want to use it. So, you know, it's a good thing to experiment with.
As far as you know, are there differences in the quality of cooking with an electric convection oven or a gas?
No more than there is between a normal electric oven and a gas oven. You know, the feature of it is that fan. And I think convections, at first, they were more prevalent in electric ovens because you need electricity anyways for the fan. So it was kind of a natural first step. You know, I find, baking in an electric oven, that the temperature control is much better than it is with a gas oven.
Really?
Yeah. It seems to hit that spot and to stay at that spot more than a gas oven does, you know, which is firing on and off with a live flame all the time. My stove at home is gas, but that's one thing I've noticed when I'm working at the test kitchen.
You love the test kitchen.
I love my test kitchen, but I don't cook there very often. It's not a terrific place to experiment.
Well, Russ, thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Russ Parsons of the Los Angeles Times food section. We've been talking about convection ovens. Read why the LA Times test kitchen is not the place for Russ's experimentation on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. He continues the thought there. Also, see a picture of the test kitchen on the blog, too. And you can find Russ Parsons in the LA Times food section each week. He's also the author of a great book that's perfect for gift giving. It's called How to Pick a Peach: The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Besides Russ Parsons, the other person I turn to when I'm looking for simple but delicious home cooking advice is the New York Times' Mark Bittman. He'll join me next to talk about soup. Perfect weather to make soup and eat it right now. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. A lot of people wait for cold weather to enjoy soup. If we did that here in Southern California, we might be waiting a very long time. However, I have to say that I make soup at least once a week at home, and of course every day in the restaurant, and most of the time the soups are water-based. So when I read Mark Bittman's column on brothless soups, I felt the joy of recognition. Mark Bittman is the New York Times go-to guy for recipes that have a wonderful simplicity and integrity to them. His landmark book, How to Cook Everything, has recently been re-released. Hi, Mark. So I love that you did this column on soups that are really easy to make, because I think people a lot of times do get hung up on the fact that they need to, I don't know, start roasting bones before they can make a soup.
To not make soup because you don't have stock is a huge mistake, as you know, as you just said, and I certainly agree. If you start at the beginning and you think, well, what is stock? Stock is water with some flavor or other dissolved in it. So does that flavor need to be meat? Of course it doesn't need to be meat. And when it's not meat, it's most often vegetables. So if you're making a vegetable soup, you're cooking vegetables in water, you sort of have the stock in there anyway.
That's how I've always thought of it. It's sort of like a self-evolving stock.
Self-evolving is nice. If you then put in some canned or these days boxed stock or broth, you might as well then just start with the worst vegetables. It's like start with the worst ingredients you can find, because once you put that stuff in there, it's not going to get any better. It's only going to get – it might have a nicer color or it might have stronger flavors, but it's not going to have better flavors.
Give us some ideas of what you like to use as your bases, and then we can talk about variations.
The one that I think is kind of most demonstrative is a shrimp and tomato soup, into which you can put rice or noodles or whatever for your third ingredient. But it basically is water, shrimp, tomatoes. And then, of course, if you have herbs or if you want to add rice or noodles, it's that much better. But if you think about it and you get some acidity from the tomatoes and you get some, you know, that great shrimpy, lobstery, whatever, shellfishy, crustacean-y flavor from the shrimp, you've really already got something very interesting going on. And poaching that in water is going to bring out their flavors, and you're going to have something, you know, very light and nice to start a meal with. Of course, you could add chopped greens. I mean, you can add chopped greens. There are some things you can add to almost any soup you want, and chopped greens is one of them. But as I said, herbs would just be fabulous. And then rice or noodles to, well, bad word, but flesh it out. Bulk it up.
Bulk it up,
bulk
yeah.
Bulk it up, I guess.
And I mean, one of the things I love to do actually is spelt. I always try and keep a little bit of spelt already cooked in my refrigerator. And that added to a lot of different soups just is wonderful. It adds that nuttiness and bulks it up a little bit.
There are two or three things you can have around pre-cooked that make your life so much easier if you like soup. And one is grains, and especially whole grains, because they don't get that gummy, starchy. You know, if you put rice in soup and you cook it, it swells into like these little balloons. But if you put brown rice or spelt or barley or grains like that, they stay nice and intact, and they, you know, they stay chewy. And the other thing, of course, is beans. If you have pre-cooked beans around, you can turn any soup into really a meal by throwing a cup of beans into it.
So do you allow yourself to use canned beans ever?
I do, but I have to say, canned beans offend me much less than canned stock does. But I have gotten into a routine of having, you know, literally 5 or even 10 kinds of beans and almost as many grains in the house all the time. And when there's not some in the refrigerator, I start cooking some more. And so once or twice a week, I cook beans or grains and I have them around.
So give us another basic soup. You had the shrimp with the tomatoes and water.
My favorite basic soup, I have to say, is egg drop soup. Not because I'm the hugest fan in the world. I mean, I really like egg drop soup. So chicken stock or water and then eggs sort of scrambled in that with soy sauce and scallions or whatever.
You know what else I love to do with eggs and soup is sometimes if I make a minestrone, some sort of vegetable soup that has a lot of vegetables in it, but I feel like I want something a little more hearty, is I'll take the portion out that I'm just going to use that night and I'll basically just crack an egg into the hot simmering soup.
Yes.
And let the egg kind of poach in there. So you get to have like this beautiful whole poached egg with that broth and all those vegetables. It's very filling and tasty.
There's hardly a soup that isn't improved by throwing an egg in there. So whether you scramble it or you let it just thicken the soup or you poach it like you're describing and then get to eat the yolk at the table, which is so great. I mean, I really like greens, croutons, a poached egg, Parmesan. So maybe that's 4 or 5 ingredients. Building on that could hardly be simpler and could hardly be better. You know, this is clearly not the kind of cooking that should be intimidating people.
Mark, it's always such a pleasure to have conversations with you. I love it.
Yes, same here.
That was Mark Bittman. Mark, of course, is the minimalist columnist for the New York Times. With the advent of technology, he's expanded his role, and he has tons of wonderful videos, and his blog, Bitten, is also quite great. And his best-selling cookbook, How to Cook Everything, has just come out in a completely updated 10th anniversary edition. Recipes for Mark are online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Have you heard about CSAs, or community-supported agriculture? That's where you buy a share of a farmer's crops, and each week or month you get a slice of the bounty of the harvest. Well, some ingenious producers in the Midwest have created a CSP&B, or community-supported preserves and bakery. More on that coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Your weekly box of seasonal vegetables from your local CSA, that is Community Supported Agriculture, but you wish it could be that easy to fill your pantry shelves. Well, it turns out that in Madison, Wisconsin, it is. Lee Davenport is a maker of preserves with Pamplemousse Preserves. Hi, Lee.
Hello.
I love the name of your company.
Oh, thanks. It was just my favorite French word.
It's a great French word. Now, we should talk about what community-supported agriculture in general is for those who don't know.
Well, in general, you pay the farmer in the spring, and you get a box of whatever he has in season, he or she has in season during the growing season.
So it's like an investment. You become a part of the farm. It gives the farmer greater stability because he knows he has this money coming in at the beginning. And then as an eater, you get the joy of having this varied box every week or every other week.
Right. And a lot of people like it because they're provided with things they might not seek out at a market. Some unusual fruits and vegetables.
I always like not having to make decisions. So for me, it's great. Somebody says, here, cook with this. And I'm like, okay.
Right.
But this idea of providing people with produce every week in this kind of way gave you an idea for something a little different.
Yeah. In the summer of 2003, I was a cook on a farm for a summer. And I remember reading an article about a woman who was doing something similar in Minnesota. So I think it's sort of been percolating in my brain ever since then. And recently, through a photography site called Flickr, I discovered that people were having sort of similar ideas around the nation. There's a community-supported pie in North Carolina, and there's community-supported fish as well. And so this is my second year selling preserves professionally, and so I thought maybe now is the time to do it.
Because as a preserve maker, what does it do? It extends your season?
Yeah. In Madison, we do have year-round markets, but the one that is year-round, you have to, in order to sell preserves there, you have to grow the fruit yourself. So I'm trying to do that, but currently I just don't grow enough to be able to sell at that market year-round. So I thought this was a nice alternative.
So this idea of community-supported preserves, you've also added bread to the mix. So describe what a box of yours would look like.
Well, I have to share my commercial kitchen, so there were other people in there using it, and I thought this model would not only benefit me, but also those other folks. So my friend Mary White makes bread, and my friend Andy Hansen makes sauerkraut and other fermented vegetables. So we've only produced one box so far, but it was beautiful, and it contained a loaf of whole grain bread, a small butter cake with plums, two chocolate hazelnut praline tartlets, a large jar of my tomato jam, and a small jar of raspberry jam, and then two different kinds of kraut. There was a dill and a caraway.
Wow, that is so great. Now, do you have a pickup point where people come to pick up the box?
Yeah, we have three right now around Madison, so it's rather convenient for people.
And how many people are supporting you now?
About 10 so far.
Oh, that's great. That's a nice beginning. And how much does the box cost?
One box costs $42, and then we split up the year into four 3-month seasonal blocks, and so if you sign up for a whole block, then the price of the box goes down to $37.50.
How fun. Boy, I sure hope there's some Santa Monica preservers listening so people would get the idea to start that out here. What a pleasure. When I first saw that you were, a CSPNB, I thought you were community-supported peanut butter.
Yeah, well, I had a brainstorm. You know how naming things for me is terrible, and we just went with that because it was, easy, but I had a little brainstorm after we had already gone through with the brochure that, we just wanted to get this going, and we see the possibility of adding more products as we go along. So I thought we should have named it community-supported comestibles and potables, because then that just means food and drink, so it would cover anything that we wanted to add.
Well, the next time you go to press.
Yes.
Lee, it's been a pleasure meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find a link to Lee Davenport's CSPNB. This is a call out to all of you incredible bread and pastry makers and preserve makers and all other producers of this kind. Start one of these yourself and let us know about it. I'd love to get a weekly or monthly basket of handmade bread and preserves. Now, in the old days, the bagel used to be a bread that was isolated to certain ethnic communities. Now it is a huge crossover hit. But the bagel of today looks very different than its smaller and harder ancestor. Stay with me on Good Food. I'll be right back to sample a bit of the history of the bagel. That's on KCRW and KCRW.com. Bagel eaters are fiercely partisan, hard and chewy, or softer and more yielding. Mostly, we love what we grew up on. So for me, that would be a dark brown, tough customer. Harder and harder to find, I must say. I always imagined everyone knew what bagels were. That is until I experienced a bit of dorm life at Berkeley called finals food, the late-night sustenance that fuels hundreds, if not thousands, of final papers. One night, a girl on my floor supplied all of us with bagels and cream cheese. We went nuts, except for one girl from the Midwest. She had a look of sort of total betrayal on her face. Turns out that she imagined a bagel to be akin to a donut, sweet and soft. I guess she didn't quite understand the hard roll's link to a difficult history of survival, which is one reason why the bagel, despite its simplicity, is sweet to so many of us. Maria Belinska grew up disliking bagels, but discovered them during university. While doing a fellowship in Poland during the 1980s, she fantasized about writing about the bagel and accumulated bagel information and stories. She's a journalist and documentary maker who specializes in Eastern Europe and the United States. She lives in London, and her book is The Bagel. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Hi, Evan.
I have to say that on the cover of your book, that bagel, which is a beautiful, super shiny, dark brown, and the hole is almost closed up because it's so substantial, is harder and harder to find.
The nice thing about this cover is you can almost feel the density and the chewiness of this bagel. It's probably a hand-rolled bagel, and it most probably doesn't have any flour enhancers in it, and it most probably, after about 5 hours, is going to be really tough on your teeth. Some of the bagels, certainly in supermarkets that you get, are much softer. This bagel that's on this cover with the very small hole is also very different from the bagel you would have found, say, 100 years ago, which would have had a much larger hole. And actually, the rope, if you want to call it that, would have been much denser.
I, of course, think of the bagel as being something that's just or Jewish.
Well, I think one of the things that's fascinating about the history of the bagel is it can be at one and at the same time very Jewish and also has these other aspects to it in its family tree. The folklore that grew up around the bagel, sort of particularly in the 19th century into the early 20th century, really anchors it in the Jewish culture.
What was so interesting to me, though, was to read about this history that I never knew, this Polish history with Jan Sobieski.
The legend that we often hear about the origin of the bagel, which is that in 1683, when Jan Sobieski, who was then King of Poland, led this multinational force against the Turks in Vienna and triumphed, a baker in Vienna created a bread in the shape of a stirrup to celebrate this great victory. And the reason why he created it in the shape of a stirrup was because Jan Sobieski was known as a great horseman. And so he presented this ring-shaped bread to Jan Sobieski, and that was the bagel. We know, however, that this legend is false because we have documentary evidence of the bagel's existence 73 years before the Battle of Vienna. So, okay, so why the Battle of Vienna is so important? And I think my theory here is that because bakers in the U.S. in the 19th century and early 20th century, the Bakers Union was dominated by German-speaking bakers. And when the Yiddish-speaking bakers arrived, you know, they began to do business, as it were, with the German-speaking bakers in terms of setting up unions and so forth. And the Battle of Vienna for German-speaking bakers was very, very important. The coat of arms comes from that time. There was a legend about bakers helping turn back the Turks by discovering a Turk in a baker's basement on the ramparts of the city. So having a legend for the Yiddish-speaking bakers that would tie in with the German-speaking bakers would make a lot of sense.
So let's go from Poland and the Battle of Vienna to America. How did the bagel first arrive in America, and about when was this?
Well, I would imagine, again, we have no exact evidence, but I would imagine it came over with the first waves of immigrants from Eastern Europe. And you start getting references to bagels in the 1880s, 1890s, whether it be in sort of people writing back to Russia saying, you know, here you can get a coffee and a bagel for less than you get some rye bread. It's sort of at the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, that people start to talk about the bagel as being something that other Americans are going to want to eat the bagel as well, and that the bagel could be successful, and that the bagel is one of these foods that is going to make an impact the way Italian pizza has.
That it can enter the multicultural life of America.
There was no question it was the right time. You know, I think there was a combination of more interest in ethnic groups, wanting to have convenient food, which the bagel is. It's a good snack food, and it's satisfying. You also had technological development, which meant that the bagel, which had been a handcraft, and that had, of course, very much limited its spread across the U.S. Finally, in the 60s, you get a machine. And that means that you can start sort of distributing bagels more widely. And then there's the idea of freezing them. The freezing, together with the mechanization, really starts meaning that bagels are everywhere.
We have to talk about the Montreal bagel because that also has such fierce protectors and backers. I have not had the pleasure of ever eating one. Tell me what a Montreal bagel is and why is it so different?
Well, the Montreal bagel is a sweeter bagel. It's a very interesting experience going up to Montreal and biting into a Montreal bagel because you bite in when you're used to New York bagel, you're expecting this certain taste in your mouth and you get something very different. They use a bit of honey or molasses.
And they use diastolic malts, don't they?
Yes, they use malts. Yes, yeah. They do. Yes. There have been bakeries that opened up selling New York bagels, and this immediately gets the press going in Canada. This sort of these wars between the New York bagel and the Montreal bagel.
I have to say, Maria, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you. The bagel. A surprising history of a modest bread is my guest Maria Balinska's rumination. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a link on how to make bagels at home. It's really not difficult, and I hope you'll give it a try. Also, I did my own taste test of some bagels recently. Results and my feedback are on the Good Food blog, which you can find at kcrw.com/goodfood. Give me your favorites there, too. Finally, what to do with that ubiquitous chicken breast? It's a staple in a lot of our weeknight dinners, and maybe it's time to look at it anew. I asked Bon Appetit magazine editor-in-chief Barbara Fairchild to take a stab at them. Stick around for some inspiration. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. The holidays are fast approaching, and we always seem to get caught up in a hectic pace of entertaining and shopping and party going. And it seems that it's really easy to find menu ideas for entertaining. But what about all those just regular, boring meals in between, when we're really too busy to cook, but we still want to strive for something a little healthy? What do we do? I know you're thinking chicken breast, but doesn't the thought of another one just make you want to go eat macaroni and cheese? Barbara Fairchild's the editor of Bon Appetit magazine, and Bon Appetit's newest book is The Bon Appetit Fast, Easy, Fresh Cookbook. Barbara, of course, was the book's editor, so I thought we'd ask her about chicken, which usually equals boring. Make it not be boring.
You know, it's funny that we're talking about this because we've actually been having a discussion at the magazine lately about what we call the chickenization of America.
Well, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, can we substitute boneless thighs if we want for some of these recipes?
Sure. I mean, the thing is, people can do what they want. I mean, cooks who are more adept and who aren't, you know, quote unquote, afraid of changing a recipe can really play around with these. I think the beauty of this book is the fact that when you open it into any two pages, you have four recipes staring you in the face. So they're short. And to speak to the point of the chicken, we knew that chicken breast was really a go-to thing for every night cooking. And that's not to say that a lot of these recipes, or really most of these recipes, could be used for entertaining as well. But the thing that is so interesting about a chicken breast, because I was thinking about this last night, is you can really do anything with it. I mean, we're talking...
It's a blank slate.
Soups, pastas, sandwiches, salads, casual, formal, chili, almost anything you can think of. And any cuisine. I mean, Italian, French, Latin, Asian, they all use chicken. And so we have a lot of chicken in the book. And I think that's one thing that people respond to. And also, it is something that you find, quite honestly, as a bargain.
And fast, mm-hmm. because boneless chicken, but boneless skinless, and then tenders.
Mm-hmm.
And
all of those. They're all there and they're all at hand. And we have fantastic ideas of how to use them.
Okay, give me some.
One of my favorite recipes from the book is actually for a whole chicken. We do sort of a new take with what we call a gremolata butter, where we take the components of traditional gremolata that's used on osso buco. We throw in some other kinds of herbs, too, with the garlic, and we have a little bit of orange peel. We make a flavored butter. You put it under the skin. It's super, super quick. Pop the chicken in the oven, and while it's roasting, you at a certain point, you open the oven and you add artichoke hearts underneath the rack where the chicken's roasting.
Can they be frozen artichoke hearts?
Absolutely, because that is a very good, high-quality convenience product that we actually do call for in the recipe. And, you know, so now the chicken and the butter and all that are basting the artichoke hearts. So you have, you know, one dish supper, and it takes an hour and 10 minutes in the oven, and you've done practically nothing, and you're roast chicken tastes entirely different.
Well, I know that one of the things I've learned to do, because I make a lot of soups at home for my mom, and usually, you know, I'm always on the weekend doing the whole, you know, whole chicken boiling forever, mm-hmm. making a beautiful Jewish chicken broth, and then using that for other things. But I've learned that I can make a really nice quick broth that's lighter but still has flavor with a couple chicken breasts and some aromatic vegetables. Then I cut them up add the head of the coconut milk.
Interesting.
A lime juice, a little bit of what I like to call rooster poop, the Vietnamese or Thai rooster chili sauce. And you have this amazing sweet, sour, spicy chicken soup that you can make in 3 seconds.
Yeah, warming and all those things. Great aroma. And the other thing that I think is really great about this is that, you know, all those things that you have in the cabinet that we occasionally send you to the store for, and you use a tablespoon of the pomegranate molasses, and now what do I do with it? Well, this book has, you know, what else to do with those kinds of intriguing ingredients that you might have bought along the way, and you need, you know, something to do with it. And again, you know, that's what makes weeknight cooking out of the ordinary. When you do go into the spice cabinet, or maybe you buy something different at the market, or use a different herb, and that is what changes it up and makes it less boring and much more interesting.
I mean, you start to get comfortable using these condiments, which we often think of condiments as something you put on food after it's already cooked. But a lot of these various ethnic condiments are things that you add into your cooking. And you learn very quickly that just a teaspoon of this and a tablespoon of that changes the flavor profile of something that you've basically been making all the time.
Right. And it does make it. Sometimes you add it right at the very end, take it off the stove or out of the oven, and, you know, you're done. And it is. It's very different and it tastes great.
Share with me a dish, a vegetable-based dish that you really loved out of the collection.
Well, you know, I'm a big Brussels sprouts fan.
Ooh,
so there
like
are a couple of Brussels sprouts, you know, recipes in there. We have where you slice the Brussels sprouts and saute them, which is, again, a quick thing to do. But I think just, again, you know, to take a Brussels sprout, which we all grew up with, just steamed and, you know, throw some butter on it. But instead, you slice it and you saute it. And maybe you add some mushrooms or a little bit of garlic, and you do it in olive oil instead of butter. And it just, it takes something and makes it entirely new.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
My pleasure. Always great to be here.
Find more simple everyday recipes from Bon Appetit magazine in the new book, Fast, Easy, Fresh. It's edited by my guest, Bon Appetit editor-in-chief Barbara Fairchild. I've got some recipes online too. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to check them out. Hey, let's meet on Facebook. You can become a fan of me, Evan Kleiman, right there. Also, did you know you can embed the show on your blog or your webpage? Go to the kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. Watch the latest video cast there too and comment on the Good Food blog. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Thanks to Karen Soriano. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.